Radio, community-based media. You can join CJSF 90.1. We're a volunteer-run community radio station, and we always have space for new volunteers to become programmers, review music, edit audio, and so much more. All the training is provided, and anyone can join. To volunteer, email our volunteer coordinator, Noel, at vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Again, that's vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Or you can visit our website, cjsf.ca. It's CJSF 90.1, diverse, independent, and yours.
There will be a power outage affecting our transmitter and terrestrial broadcast signal from 10 p.m. tonight until 6 a.m. Thursday morning. You can still tune in online and listen to us via streaming audio. We apologize in advance for the inconvenience this causes to tuning in to your favorite shows.
I feel that if we don't activate our sense of interconnectedness with all life, if we don't start sowing the seeds of what I have called Earth democracy, we are going to see 99% people as disposable. So this is the time to make oneness and interconnectedness as one humanity on one planet the political project of our times.
That's Vandana Shiva, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vandana Shiva on interconnectedness. The corporate takeover of food with its toxic chemical inputs poses serious health and environmental problems. Corporate agriculture, the New York Times states unequivocally, is causing irreparable harm to the planet. It is ravaging the air, soil, and water, destroying wildlife habitats, and spurring climate chaos. The system, the Times continues, is a vast web of industries and processes that stretches from seed to pasture to packaging to supermarket to trash dump. It produces at least a third of all human-caused greenhouse gases, unquote. There are alternatives. We can learn much from traditional organic farming techniques as practiced by indigenous farmers. In this program, Vandana Shiva describes the importance of biodiversity and the interconnectedness of all life. She says, quote, "What we do to the earth, what we do to the land, what we do to biodiversity eventually comes back to us. There is no separation," unquote. Our guest today is Vandana Shiva. She's an internationally renowned voice for sustainable development and social justice. She's a physicist, scholar, and social activist. She's a founder of Navdanya and director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy in New Delhi. She's the recipient of the Sydney Peace Prize and of the Right Livelihood Award. She's the author of many books, including Water Wars, Earth Democracy, Soil Not Oil, and Oneness Versus the 1%. She spoke at an event organized by the Graduate School of Design at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And now, Vandana Shiva.
Thank you so much to the wonderful young women of the Graduate School of Design for organizing a whole week to celebrate Women's Power. And most importantly, to celebrate it at a time where the world needs it desperately. We're living through times when life on Earth itself is threatened. You know, design isn't just in the obvious field of design. Even science is about design. Because the way you design the world in your mind is the way you relate to it in the real world. And when you design it as dead matter just to be exploited, you will exploit it. When you design it without any understanding of limits, you will violate the planetary limits. When you design it with deep recognition of interconnectedness, you will nurture those relationships. And this basic recognition is what I drew from my learnings in quantum theory, that non-locality, non-separation, interconnectedness, that is the nature of reality. But we have a design in the paradigm of mechanistic thought which didn't evolve, it was imposed. That mechanistic thought is based first on the assumption that we are separate from nature, and nature is constituted of discrete particles separate from each other who can only relate through violence, through force, through action by contact. In the quantum world, there is no separability. Everything is interconnected. There are no fixed, essentialized qualities that have been built into the way people are looked at, nature is looked at. Potential is the defining quality in the quantum world. The fixed immutable particles that cannot change need force. And the kind of force that's now being applied through chemicals, even through the genetic manipulation, where the idea is that a gene is not in relationship with the whole genome and the complexity of living organisms, and it's not in relationship with all the organisms it relates to. A gene is an atom. In fact, the word originally used for genes was atoms of biological determinism. Quantum theory is based on the psi function, the potential. And because it's about potential, it's also about uncertainty. The mechanical world is based on a false illusion of determinateness, certainty. And in the quantum world, we know we cannot get rid of uncertainty, the uncertainty principle of Heisenberg. To this is linked to the fourth principle, no excluded middle, no duality, no either or. In the quantum world, it's and. In the mechanistic world, you can either be a wave or a particle. In the quantum world, you have potential to be both, and they're complementary. This is Bohr's complementary principle. And what I evolved in my mind in those years of training my mind out of mechanistic thought into quantum thought is the way all indigenous people have thought. All indigenous cultures are based on relationship, on kinship, as being part of the earth. Part of what's happening right now is fires in Australia. And more people are realizing that the Aboriginal people had systems of management based on fires. And they weren't bush people. They were gardeners. And they could keep living with that same land over thousands and thousands of centuries because they saw themselves as part of the earth. I just read a poem, Mother Earth, by an Aboriginal poet. I belong to this land. It runs through my veins. It's the earth in my bones. It's the feeling I get when I return to my place. It's deep down inside me. It's my Mother Earth space. Whether it's Pachamama as the organizing principle of the Andean cultures, or India, what I love about India is we can always give 100 names. The Ganga has hundreds of names. The feminine has so many names. Bhumi, Vasundhara, Prithvi. You can choose whichever expression you prefer. Because when you realize that the world is one interconnected whole, you also realize that what appears different is actually different expressions of an interconnected reality. That's the ecological principles I learned from my very early days of activism in the 70s from an amazing movement of women. And I'd like to honor them. I'd like to express my gratitude because I say I went to the University of Western Ontario to learn the foundations of quantum theory deeply. But I went to the University of Chipko, where women who'd never been to school were my professors because they lived the forest. They knew more biodiversity than any expert. And long before the international community started to develop the language of ecological functions and services of nature, and I remember this so clearly, women came out with lanterns during the day, and the police was there, and the officers were there, and they said, you stupid women, can't you see? The sun is out. You don't need lanterns. And they said, no, it's not for the sun, it's for you. Because you seem to imagine that these forests are timber mines. But these forests are our mothers, and they give us soil, water, and pure air. And then there was a flood in 1978, and the World Bank had to wake up to the fact, yes, the forests had watershed functions. And our government then made a policy responding to the Chipko women to say logging in the high altitudes, commercial logging would stop. But the discussion on air went on. They said, oh, stupid things, how can they think trees have anything to do with air? When the basic photosynthetic reality is that the carbon dioxide we breathe out is what only green plants can convert to oxygen and make it air. Now this is part of the climate work, except that again, instead of saying forests perform this function and are the lungs of the earth, there's now an attempt to trade in the ecological functions, besides the destruction of the last lungs and the last livers. It breaks my heart to see what's happening to the Amazon. For some more GM soya, some more meat, and it's not just the biodiversity of the Amazon that's being exterminated. The indigenous cultures are being exterminated, continuing a 500-year legacy of extermination of the local, the indigenous, the diverse. The worldviews of the earth as living herself is now recognized in science. James Lovelock talked about the Gaia hypothesis. That he was a NASA scientist, and he realized that the Earth organizes her temperatures. She organizes her climate. And as I say, the disruption of her organizing capacity is the instability that is now leading to temperature increases, untimely rainfall, all that we talk of as climate change. I refer to it as climate chaos. We have extreme events, unpredictable, uncertain. We have hailstorm in the peak of summer. We have floods in deserts. And we have warming and melting of the snows and ice of the world. It's happening in the Arctic, it's happening in Antarctic, but it's happening in the third pole, my region, the Himalaya. We did a study and a short film on climate change at the third pole. And it's interesting because working with the communities, they tell you, you know, this glacier was 25 meters thick. It's now 2 feet. We might see the disappearance of the Himalayan glaciers, which means that half of humanity, which depends on the waters of the Himalaya for their drinking water and their irrigation, half of humanity will be deprived of water. We haven't even started to imagine the countries dependent on the glacial melt having to live without it. No one has imagined what the disappearance of the perennial Ganga and a conversion into a seasonal stream will mean for one third of India that is in the Gangetic Basin. But not only are the diverse species interconnected, The beauty of it is they are self-organized. I think one of the problems with the mechanistic paradigm and the mechanistic design in the mind projected onto the world is that it assumes that the only change can be external, and it can only be through violence. But every cell, every microbe, every being is autonomous and autopoietic, self-organized and free, dynamic and evolving, but not isolated in its autonomy and its self-organization. It's interconnected and non-separable. When you shift to self-organization and organization from within, you realize that you can have interconnectedness and autonomy together. A problem with the reductionist worldview. Scientists from Maturena and Varela have identified all living systems as autopoietic, organized from within. Machines, on the other hand, are allopoietic systems, assembled and controlled externally. One of the most dramatic ontological shifts of our time is redefining living organisms, especially seeds, as machines invented by corporations. And this has guided this illusion of seeds as machines and inventions, and therefore patentable, is what has guided my life since 1987 when I first heard this. I said, this is madness. And yet this madness gets repeated as science. And this madness then becomes international intellectual property law. And this madness is then even tried to be imposed in bilateral talks. Because I woke up to this so early, long before the WTO came, I was able to work with my government. We had different governments then. It was the 80s. We had different parliaments too. I could work with our ambassador in the GATT, and we could change the GATT, which earlier the draft that Monsanto had brought was parties had to patent seeds and living resources. This was changed to parties can exclude from patentability plants and animals, and for seeds they could create a sui-generis system. So I went back to India, started to work with our government and parliament. We passed laws. I was invited to. There was no one else talking about it, so they asked me to help draft the laws. We managed to get in our patent law a clause: plants, animals, and seeds are not human inventions. It's a simple recognition of kinship in law. That plants, animals, and seeds are part of our extended family of life. I call it the Earth family. The problem is the word family has become so abused because of patriarchal readings and patriarchal domination. But a family means kinship. And when the whole world is your family, then every tree, every blade of grass, every microbe, the elephant, the big cats, and everyone of diversity in our human cultures, our human colors. I mean, it's very strange because till colonialism, everyone knew they're people of different colors, but it wasn't a problem. It was diversity. And racism was born out of capturing blacks from Africa as slaves and bringing them to work in the cotton fields and in the sugarcane plantations. And that's where racism was born. Exactly the same process that led to the idea that indigenous people weren't fully human. And the same process led to the idea of women being like the earth, inert, dead matter, or at best, reproductive machines. I remember, this must be about 25 years ago, I had been invited to a keynote in one of the five colleges. And I was looking through the archives to get a sense of how this college came to be. And in the archival material, there are these debates that if women start to study, their brains will grow, and therefore their uterus will shrink. That's how mechanical thinking was. And it still is, unfortunately, because mechanistic thought is based on separation, disconnection, and essentialism. And it defines women as purely reproductive machines. It defines people of color as inferior, and it defines indigenous people as not having any human capacity. It defines diversity of humanity into nature, which is now just dead matter, to be conquered, to be owned. This birth of capitalist patriarchy comes out of the 500 years of colonialism, which morphed into the 300 years of fossil fuel-based industrialism. And we're living in the continuity of both. When I was trying to make sense of why is it that women were rising to protect the forest, to protect the rivers, I realized that it wasn't by accident that we think mechanically about the world. We've designed our paradigms to declare war against the earth. This is basically saying there is no earth family, because it has declared other species as inferior species, creatures, and therefore because the indigenous people take care of other species, they too are an inferior culture. So in the 60s and the 70s, the use of that time, they didn't call it physics, they called it natural philosophy, but natural philosophy and a fundamentalist Christianity became part of the extermination. They became part of one colonizing mission. And this then got accelerated a century ago with the oil, but two centuries ago before with coal. And fossil industrialism is, everyone recognizes, the main driver of climate change. Because what you're basically doing is extracting 600 million years of nature's work to take what she had buried underground and fossilized into coal, into gas, into oil, extract it and run the industrial machine way beyond the recycling capacity of the earth. And not only are you pumping so much, the earth's own capacity of recycling the living carbon, recycling the living nitrogen is there, but when you pump out every year 20 million years of her work on fossilization and turning it into dead carbon, you're also simultaneously destroying the capacity of reabsorption. You're destroying the forests, you're destroying the soils, you're destroying the farmers. I realized while doing my work for the United Nations University, for which I was working on a program on conflicts over resources, I said, there's conflicts here, and I think it has to do with resources and it doesn't have anything to do with religion. I'd like to investigate, and I did, and I wrote a book called The Violence of the Green Revolution. And I realized that the chemicals we use as progress in science are actually chemicals that were developed first, originally, for Hitler's labs. By IG Farben, the cartel that is still the one running agriculture. Right now, they've become a cartel again because Bayer has been bought. Bayer has bought Monsanto. Dow and DuPont have merged, and Syngenta has merged with ChemChina, and then there's BASF. You might have been following the cases in this country. BASF and Monsanto have had rulings on the dicamba drift, which is, you know, it's Roundup use led to Roundup resistance. So dicamba was then used for killing the weeds, but it drifts. And a peach farmer got a $235 million ruling recently. But three farmers before that got cancer rulings, victories in cancer cases. Last time I talked to lawyers, there were more than 80,000 cases in this country of cancer victims because of the use of Roundup. And here again is evidence that what we do to the earth, what we do to the land, what we do to biodiversity eventually comes back to us. There is no separation. So the health of the planet and our health is one health. The health of the planet is both the amazing capacity of the Earth to regulate our climate systems, and we disrupt those regulatory processes, you basically do what the problem of diabetes is. Diabetes is called a metabolic disease. I call climate change the planetary metabolic disease. Pumping too much carbon dioxide, too much nitrogen oxide. Nitrogen fertilizers emit nitrous oxide, which is 300 times more lethal for climate instability. And most of the methane is coming either from animal factory farms or the huge dumps of garbage. The sources of greenhouse gases. I'd written this book, Soil Not Oil. This was 2009. And that's when I said, why aren't they looking at the soil? And at that point, my assessment was about 45% of the greenhouse gases come from a system of producing food that's fully based on fossil fuels and chemicals derived from fossil fuels. The petrochemical industry is a fossil fuel industry. The figures now are the production is contributing 11 to 15% of greenhouse gases. Land use change and deforestation, it sounds very tame, but it's basically chopping the Amazon and the rainforests of Indonesia for palm oil, is 15 to 20%. Processing, transport, packaging, retail is 20%. And at the end of it, you get degraded food that gives you chronic diseases. It's not food anymore. I say you've turned food into anti-food, because food is supposed to nourish you. On the other hand, as I shared those figures with you, we have a system. If we co-create with the living earth and get out of this trap that the earth is inert and dead and we are her conquerors, and we reestablish the recognition that we are part of the earth and as participants in her processes, we can practice non-violently. And in this non-violence lies the hope for the future. All the data is showing that at the rate at which we have been recycling carbon and nitrogen on our farm, if the whole world farmed through biodiversity, whole world farmed organically, we could actually reverse climate change. And we'd have good food, and we'd have livelihoods, and we'd have peaceful societies. Because what the biodiversity is doing is pulling out that excess carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide from the atmosphere through the plants and putting it back where it belongs in the soil. This is a living earth solution. It's the denial of the life of the earth and her capacities to create, to heal, to recycle that has allowed an illusion of conquest, but a system that's gone crazy is not a system in which you are in charge. The idea of conquest has given us this world, this new little being that's brought panic to everyone. And then the title of The Economist says, and it's going global. We're supposed to stay local. Only the big players were supposed to be global. How can these nasty, pesty viruses go global? It throws the system into disarray, because when you discount the life of the other, it could be a microbe, you in fact create a recipe for disorder. No wall will prevent this moving. So I started to save seeds 87 onwards to defend the integrity of the seed, the diversity of the seed, the freedom of the farmers to save and exchange seeds. And initially, we just saved seeds of food crops, because that's where the biggest assault was. But then suicide started in the cotton area. And basically, in a very, very rapid period, I won't go into too much detail, but 99% of the cotton became BT Cotton owned and controlled by Monsanto, who locked Indian companies into licensing arrangements, got the farmers to give up their seeds through something called seed replacement, and there was a monopoly. That's when I started saving cotton seeds. And then we started to work with farmers to do organic cotton. And then I started to work with the Khadi ashrams to spin